From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callis. And later in the program, California business and political leaders start a campaign to bring the Winter Olympics to Tahoe. Also, we'll talk about the royal wedding with the owner of a British tea room in Sacramento. And on this week's Sound Advice, Nick Bruner, host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's weekly online indie music show. But first, perhaps like me, you fantasized about living off the fat of the land. But then reality intrudes, or what you think is reality. Could you really live on a regular-sized piece of land in a city and grow your food for a year? One Davis family recently learned that they could do it, more or less. Spring Warren ripped out the lawn and grew or raised 75% of the family's food. Now she's written a book about it called The Quarter Acre Farm. She's in our studio. Spring Warren, welcome back to Insight.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
What did your husband and two sons say when you said, guess what I'm going to do?
Well, it wasn't met with full support, to say the least. My eldest son was in full support of it. He worked as a chef at the time, and he was an avid gardener, and he thought this was a great idea. However, he didn't live at home, and so he wasn't going to be forced to take part in it.
Easy for him to say.
Exactly. That's what my younger son said. The younger son said, you know, you're sort of, this is already in process. It's the summer is full on. Maybe you should take more time, plan ahead and do it maybe another time, which I thought meant perhaps like after I've gone for college.
Yes.
And my husband said, are you crazy? You'll starve, which meant, are you crazy? I'll starve.
Yes. So what did they think it would involve? How did they think their diet would change if you actually went ahead with this? And of course, you did go ahead with it.
Yes. Well, they were initially right. The diet changed just the way they thought it was going to in terms of my preparation was not very good. So that first month that I did this was the month of zucchini. And I think that they sat at the dinner table every night and watched me eat my zucchini and various forms and thought they had called it right. And they were very glad they didn't take part.
Well, how did you turn things around so that you could actually have a balanced and interesting diet for a year?
Well, I had planted a lot more things, a lot more plants. And once they started being in production, then, of course, my diet became much more varied. And it was something then the rest of the family wanted to jump in and take part in.
My guest is Spring Warren of Davis. She's author of The Quarter Acre Farm, How I Kept the Patio, Lost the Lawn, and Fed My Family for a Year. Give people an idea about the amount of space around your home and how much of it you actually dedicated to food production.
Well, our lot is a typical size lot. It's actually not a quarter acre. It's slightly less than a quarter acre. And then of that space, of course, there's the footprint of the house on that less than quarter acre. And there are several patios. There's actually three small patios. There's a driveway. There's bushes. There's some trees. And then we have some animals. So they take up part of that space.
So what's left?
So what's left is plenty to grow an entire family's worth of food. It's really amazing how much you can grow in a relatively small space.
I guess you had to keep cycling through crops because with that amount of space and several hungry people in the household, you had to go through one crop and then quickly plant another one?
Well, there are two periods of time in which the sort of the translation from winter to summer crops happens, and that's a pretty intense time. But as right now, I have all my summer stuff in pretty much. And so there was some number of time in which it was just very intense. You pull out the old stuff and you put the new stuff in. And then all of that just starts producing. And it's amazing. I always say that I wish that houses could work the way that gardens do. Then you could start a door jamb and just sit back and wait and the house would grow around it.
Yeah.
But that's the way gardens work. You plant it, you sort of prep for it, and you get it going, and then it sort of takes over.
What gave you the idea for this? What motivated you?
I was doing research on my next book, which is set in North Dakota. And so we had driven up toward North Dakota. And during that trip, it was the summer of the Salmonella scare. And so we were driving across country, going to cafes and places, and there wasn't a tomato to be seen. You know, that was like, oh, poison tomatoes, can't eat those. And then they thought, it's not the tomatoes, it's the peppers. Maybe it's not the peppers, maybe it's the lettuce. And it was just this very strange time in which it was hard to eat on this trip. And not only that, we were going through vast stretches of corporate farming landscapes in which, you know, things were being planted. You weren't sure what exactly GMOs, whatever it was. Things were being sprayed on it. You didn't know what it was. We were going through feedlots like at Coalinga. And, of course, those are very sobering, to say the least. And I just started thinking, this is crazy. We don't know what we're putting in our mouths. This is just nuts. And my husband was driving, and I was fantasizing. And the next thing I knew, I said, I've got this great idea. This is what's going to happen.
What were the ground rules you established for yourself so that you could do this credibly, but also in a way that would work for you and the family?
Well, first of all, I actually wrote down everything I ate for a year because of, you know, this challenge I had set and this sort of disbelief that I was met. I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to prove to people. But the ground rules were that 75% by weight, everything that I ate would come from the quarter acre farm. And if I wanted to go away, for instance, I went away and did a writer's retreat for 2 weeks, I had to eat extra quarter acre farm produce to make up for that 2 weeks that I wasn't going to eat any at all. So I was very stringent about that. The other 25% I could spend any way I wanted. Pasta, cheese, chocolate cake, you know, anything that I wanted. And so that gave me some wiggle room.
Thinking about all the things that you ended up eating from your quarter acre farm, a.k.a. your garden, what would have surprised you the most going into it?
Well, for pure shock value, I actually did eat the snails in our yard.
Because they were eating the lettuce.
That's right. I thought,
so you ate them.
Exactly. Fair's fair. But there's a lot of things that were surprising to me that I did eat, including I found out the leaves of a lot of plants were very nutritious. For instance, black-eyed pea leaves have more calcium than milk.
Wow.
And there's a lot of things like sweet potatoes. I started growing sweet potatoes. And sweet potatoes are not only something that grows incredibly well here, which I never hear about anybody growing, but also their leaves are very nutritious and edible as well.
So you were making extra use out of these crops, even eating the parts that you didn't think you'd eat.
Yes, I think that we have a very narrow education about what's edible and what's good to eat that's based on what's easy to get to a supermarket.
If I may, let's get back to the snails, because a lot of us have eaten escargot,
yes,
where you get these shapeless little bits of protein in a little tray, and they're totally covered with olive oil and garlic and so on, and you just slip it in your mouth. Another thing to hunt down these snails like you did, I guess.
Well, if you live in this area, of course, you know that snails are ubiquitous and they're a big problem. But they are the same snails. They're culinary snails. They were brought from France. So it seemed like an okay thing to do, and I did take them. I found them, which was really easy in my garden. You just turn over a log, and there you have them.
And they don't run too fast.
They run slightly faster than I do, but still I managed to creep up on them, so it was okay. And I put them in a terrarium at first, and then I made sort of an escargotiere, a place to raise them, and I fed them on lettuces and things that I knew were okay to eat.
So it's like a ranch.
Exactly. And eventually I did them in, which was the hardest thing for me.
Can you tell us what that involves?
Oh, my gosh. That involved, first of all, I drowned them in beer, which I thought was the most humane thing to do. If I have to go, that might be all right.
Could be worse ways to go.
That's right. Gin perhaps might be even better. But barring that, so once they're done in, then you have to start putting them through successive changes of water, and they produce an incredible amount of slime because they have little capsules inside themselves, little tiny bits of things called mucin, that when a little bit of calcium and then mostly water, when it hits, it expands larger than, say, a car's emergency bag.
Wow.
So they
have to flush them out, basically.
Yes, and that stuff just keeps producing and producing and producing. And if I had, you know, it's if I had a little bit less squeamishness about them, I could have, say, applied that slime to my skin, because supposedly it is a fantastic sort of cure-all to all sorts of skin problems.
My guest is Spring Warren, author of The Quarter Acre Farm. It's a book she's written about the year that she spent growing and producing her own food out of what was her lawn, essentially, at the family home in Davis. They produced 75% of the family's food by weight from the garden. Now, we also have a video of you in your garden on our website, capradio.org/insight. Our new multimedia producer, Andrew Nixon, did it, and it's a really nice video. And one thing I've got to say is, looking at the video, your dirt looks awesome. It is so black and rich looking. How do you make it like that?
Oh, man. You know, everything that's in the garden goes back into the garden, and we do have my secret weapon for good garden dirt are our rabbits. So we have two rabbits, and people always look over and say, oh, do you eat them? I say, no, we don't eat them. But they are so useful. We use their manure. And two rabbits produce, by dry weight, as much manure as one full-grown steer in a year. So they are incredibly productive, and the manure builds soil, and you don't have to compost it, you don't have to age it, nothing. You can practically take your rabbit, hold it over your beds, and squeeze if you wanted to. And so between that and the composting of all the garden greens and getting coffee from coffee houses that just give that stuff away, we just make up our own dirt over and over again.
And I guess that dirt is part of the secret behind your chard, because in your blog there's a recipe for cheesy chard grilled sandwich. You added all those E's in the cheesy. And the thing that really stood out for me was the chard. I mean, this was like chard from another planet, from some sci-fi movie. They're huge leaves. I mean, they look great, but how do you grow them like that? Because of the dirt?
I guess so. You know, there are different, I have to be honest, there are different cultivars of chard, and some are going to be smaller and some are going to be larger. But I did have an exceptional chard year, and chard is something that, for those people who are looking for something to grow that's really, really easy to grow, chard is exceptional. And chard also will grow in the winter, and it will grow in the summer.
Wow.
So
I recently grew my first spinach.
Yay.
And while I have no problems pulling every weed out of the ground, I will say this. When it was time to harvest the spinach, I felt squeamish about cutting it off at the ground. It was almost like, well, of course it's a living thing, but I just felt this connection to the spinach because I'd grown it that I would never have imagined. Do you ever have that problem?
You know, I sympathize greatly. You know, I think that that's one of the reasons that I feel like I take very special care of my garden, is because I feel like once you plant something, it's like getting a pet or an animal, that you then are responsible for it. And so I would say probably in the same way that I feel a lot less negative about people, you know, about eating meat or eating eggs from chickens that I know have a very good life, then I feel much better about eating plants that have had a full and happy and well-tended life as well.
Yeah. You've got a couple of events this weekend, including one on Sunday afternoon at the Avid Reader in Sacramento. And I read in your blog that it says, Sunday at 4 p.m., Jesse and I will be reading and printing at the Avid Reader in Sacramento. What do you mean printing? Isn't the book already done?
Well, this is a really great opportunity for people. My son, my eldest son, who is all for the project and living away from home, he is a fantastic artist, and he did all the illustrations in the book. And he is going to be there with me at both Avid Readers on both days, and he is going to be pulling prints. So you can get an original print free from Jesse, and I keep telling people, laughing, you may have heard enough from me and you don't want to hear me again, but this is a great opportunity to go ahead, get a print from Jesse, which will, you know, by far be worth all of the time and trouble you might have getting there.
Now, the beautiful illustrations I especially like on the cover, there's like this fold away from the front cover, and you see the snail with its head to the ground like it's trying to run away from you. I don't know.
That's right. I'm coming up behind. Be careful.
Spring Warren's book is The Quarter Acre Farm, How I Kept the Patio, Lost the Lawn and Fed My Family for a Year. She's got book readings this weekend, 7:30 p.m. on Friday at the Avid Reader in Davis, and as we just talked about, at 4 p.m. on Sunday at the Avid Reader in Sacramento. Spring Warren, it was a pleasure talking with you again.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, California business and political leaders start a campaign to bring the Winter Olympics to Tahoe. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later this morning on Talk of the Nation, more on NPR's series about prostitutes in Nashville trying to make new lives for themselves. Guests are reporter Jackie Lydon, plus the head of Magdalene, an institution helping the women, and one of the graduates. Also, what the U.S. is doing about human trafficking and race and adoption. How should parents raise adopted kids of another race? Talk of the Nation starts at 11 here on Capital Public Radio. 2022 seems a long way off, but when you're in the Olympic Games business, it's just around the corner. So California decided now was a good time to start their bid to bring the 22 Winter Games to the Lake Tahoe region. Why are business and political leaders doing this, and what does bidding for the Games involve? Joining us is Michael Faust, who's the president of the California Winter Games Committee. Michael, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you very much, Jeffrey, for having me on.
Why 2022?
Well, the reality is 2022 is not necessarily the specific date we're looking at. What we're doing is we're putting together an exploratory committee to make sure that we have the opportunity for the next available bid opportunity that the United States Olympic Committee may chase in the near future. Obviously, that's the next one that's up in line to be considered by the IOC and the USOC. And so we want to make sure that when they start their process later this fall, and we're ready to go with all the facts, figures, and all the information they have.
The last time the Winter Games were in the U.S. was 2002 in Salt Lake City. And,
yes,
of course,
sir.
You were in North America just in 2010. So I guess you're figuring that kind of amount of time will be enough for the Games to come back to this part of the world?
Yeah, I mean, there's no guarantee of where the IOC will eventually make its decision to send the Games. What we want to do and what the California Winter Games Committee is doing is very simply, we're starting the process. We know that we've got a phenomenal resource in Tahoe. The 1960 Winter Olympics in Squaw Valley were legendary, and they were magical events, and something that has created a phenomenal legacy for the Tahoe region. And what we want to do is we're starting in partnership with the folks over at the Reno Tahoe Winter Games Coalition, and we're starting to put together the information that the USOC may need when they start looking around and saying who can host the next Winter Olympic Games. And what we want to do is make sure that we've gathered the information, we provide it to them as they need it to best position California for that opportunity. And we're doing it for a lot of different reasons, but the major reason we're doing it is because there's an enormous economic impact that will come from hosting a game in the future. Not only the hundreds of thousands of jobs that potentially will be created, when you look at Vancouver, 45,000 jobs were created during that three-week period, plus hundreds of thousands of jobs before, and the legacy of Vancouver and the tourism industry and just the branding that occurred through that will help put Tahoe back on the world stage with billions of people looking to that the future, and we think it'd be a great economic driver for our region.
Michael Faust is president of the California Winter Games Committee. You said that there would be an enormous economic impact, but there have been some Olympic cities and regions that have been paying off bills for years. Maybe most famously, Montreal, which hosted the Summer Olympic Games, took them decades to pay off the bills. How do you know that there would be a long-term positive economic impact?
That's a great question. So you got to look at modern Olympic Games and ask how the funding formulas are put together, and you got to look at what's happened in the past. First of all, we're doing this as an exploratory effort. What you're asking there, how do we pay for it? What are the specifics? You know, we're not saying we have all the answers. We're starting the process today. We're not standing here with a plan. We're standing here saying we're starting the process. And it's going to be a community-wide conversation, stakeholders, working with the local folks all over California that have the opportunity to participate. So we're not saying we have the answers. What we're saying is we're starting the process and starting the conversation. But if you look at places like Vancouver and Torino and Salt Lake, the economic impact of Vancouver was $1 billion direct. Their operating budget there was $1.88 billion, and they broke even as an operation. Torino, once again, a break-even operation, a direct economic impact of more than $1.8 billion to Torino alone. Salt Lake City, their operating committee, and that's an American Games, which is an important correlation to draw, their operating committee actually ran a profit of in excess of $60 million. And it had an indirect economic benefit to the Salt Lake region of more than $4 billion. So, you know, drawing comparisons to cities and countries outside the states, outside of North America, is just a little different in the conversation. And the reality is we're going to go through this process. We're going to identify the challenges that are there. We're going to identify the right kind of business plan to go forward with. And we just want to make sure that as the USOC gets ready to make its decision of what community it may engage with for it, that the Tahoe region is the best positioned region for that kind of choice.
When the Olympic Games, the Winter Olympics, were held in Squaw Valley, the federal government built Interstate 80 going across the Sierra Nevada. Would you see similar large-scale government investment if the Games were to come back to Tahoe?
Well, you know, we expect there would be substantial investment from all kinds of avenues, not only the federal, not only the state, potentially local investment at all. But the reality is this. When the Winter Olympics were in Squaw Valley, in 1955, Squaw Valley won the opportunity to host the Games. In 1955, it had one ski lift, two tow ropes, and a 50-room lodge. Okay. By 1960, roads have been built, bridges have been built, hotels have been built. You probably visit those hotels. Restaurants have been built, ice arena, ski jumps, ski speed skating tracks, ski lifts, you know, and they were the first people to have an Olympic Village. And all that happened in a very short period of time. And think about what's happened since 1960. People have visited those restaurants. People have used those roads. People have you know, driven across those bridges. People have utilized those hotels. The long-term economic benefit, not only for Squaw, but everywhere from Reno to Sacramento, the economic benefit of people traveling there and visiting there and skiing there and eating there, is enormous, and no one's ever stopped to ask the calculations of what have been the long-term benefits of having a Games in Squaw. But I'll tell you, it's one of those reasons why we keep going back as a family. It's one of those reasons why millions of people visit Tahoe, because it has that you know, magical history of the Squaw Valley Olympics, and it created that infrastructure that's allowed millions of people to go back there and visit year after year after year.
Now, your committee, you've talked about Squaw Valley a few times. Is your committee assuming that the Games would be in Squaw Valley if they were to go to Tahoe?
You know, it's interesting you say that. So the Games have changed dramatically since 1960. In 1960, there were 750 total athletes. In 2010, there was more than 2,600 athletes. In 1960, there was 30 nations. In 2010, there was 82 nations. In 1960, there was 27 events. In 2010, there was 86 events. And in a future Games, you got to assume that it's going to be closer to what we're talking about in the 2010 numbers, if not larger. With 86 different events, it would be our expectation that you would probably see facilities for the Games spread everywhere from the Sacramento region all the way over to the Reno region, and a dozen beautiful sites along the mountains in between.
In 1960, they held the skating events up at High Camp, I believe, at Squaw Valley. It's not realistic to imagine that the skating events and ice hockey could happen there. You need a big arena, and an arena is probably too big for the Tahoe region. Does this bid depend on a new arena in Sacramento?
It's way too early to speculate on any of that stuff. And that's part of the process that we have to go through in partnership with the Reno Tahoe Coalition. What we're doing is we're starting the process, starting to identify not only the roadblocks are out there, the impediments are out there, but the opportunities exist, and trying to develop that roadmap of how we get from where we are now to the opportunity to be considered by the USOC as a contender for the Olympics in the future. And you do that through a process, and part of it is, of course, the venue conversation, part of it is the transportation process. But part of it that we want to make sure that we focus on is California has a long legacy of being incredibly environmentally friendly. We want to make sure that as we go forward with any potential bid in the future, that what we're doing is making sure that we provide an opportunity to provide the greenest games ever.
How do you know the people in the Tahoe Basin who live in the Tahoe Basin would want something as gigantic as the Winter Olympics coming there?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we've done some early polling, and I'll tell you the numbers are fantastic, and we'll release that information down the road. But here's the thing. So it's a community process and a community conversation. And by no way, shape, or form are we saying that it's going to happen or it needs to happen. What we're saying is we want to take time. We want to engage the community, engage especially the local community that's in the Tahoe Basin, and have that conversation with them and say, you know, if this was to happen, what does that look like to you? If this is to happen, is this something you can support? We need to make sure that everyone's point of view is considered, all the variables are worked through, and we want to make sure we do it in a very collaborative way, one that engages the community at every step of the way. And it's a conversation that needs to occur. It's not a top-down conversation. It's really a bottom-up conversation, and that's what you're seeing with the California Winter Games Committee is group of folks just like you and I who got together and said, you know, if we're going to position ourselves to potentially have this, we need to start that conversation. The first deadlines for this really are not only later this year when the USOC will make a decision whether they're going to pursue a Winter Olympic bid in the future, but early in 2012, the USOC, assuming they decide to go forward with a potential bid, that you know they will invite communities to submit information to them to be considered, and by 2013, somewhere in 2013, they'll actually nominate a city to the IOC, assuming they go forward with a bid option. So, I mean, this conversation has to happen. It has to happen soon. Decisions are going to be made in the very near future, and that's it. I mean, it's this public conversation, and it's the dialogue that has to happen between everybody.
And finally, Michael Faust, the folks in Nevada have been sort of working on this general issue, trying to bring the Winter Olympics back to Tahoe for several years now.
Yep.
And that's the Reno Tahoe Winter Games Coalition. There's now the California Winter Games Committee.
Yep.
Since Tahoe has both a California side and a Nevada side, wouldn't it make more sense to unify those two campaigns so that there's a committee lobbying for the Tahoe region?
Jeffrey, you're reading my mind, my friend. So the way this works is very simple. Is we're starting the California conversation in earnest. Really, you know, in the past couple of weeks, we've been having this conversation in earnest on the California side. We're starting to get some of the organizational infrastructure in place now so that we can be an active participant and an active partner with the Reno Tahoe Group. They've been working in Nevada very hard. They've had some conversations. And we actually started because they came over to this region and said, we need help. We need a California organization to partner with. In fact, we had a phenomenal conversation with their leadership last night. And, you know, everyone's in agreement that as we continue to move forward, eventually we'll roll up into a single unified organization and we'll move forward with a unified bid. And we're doing this in conjunction and collaboration with them. There's not two separate organizations in theory. There is in practicality in terms of technical 501c3s, but we're working for the same common goal. And as we get ready to provide our best foot forward, we'll do it in a unified fashion, both on the California and Nevada side, with a common vision around Tahoe.
Michael Faust, president of the California Winter Games Committee, which has just started its campaign to try and bring the Winter Olympic Games to the Tahoe region. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk about the royal wedding with the owner of a British tea room in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to our website, capradio.org/insight. Today you'll find that video we talked about earlier by Andrew Nixon. He went to Spring Warren's home in Davis to find out more about her quarter-acre farm, and you'll see some of the food that she made out of the produce that came from her quarter-acre farm. And you'll find links to our guests, more information about our program. Tomorrow, our guests include the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Ghana, also Antigone, a story of power and fate, best known as a tragedy by the ancient Greek playwright Sophocles. An updated retelling of Antigone opens in the Sacramento stage this weekend. And Planet of the Vampire Women, a new sci-fi adventure film shot in Sacramento, gets its premiere this weekend. That's Insight tomorrow here on Capital Public Radio. Also tomorrow, there's a wedding. You might have heard about it. It involves a certain William Windsor and Kate Middleton. I'm talking, of course, about the royal wedding. It happens in the late morning British time. For royal wedding fans in California, it means staying up very late or getting up very early. Most TV coverage will start at 1 a.m. Friday morning, our time. Joining us to talk about the royal wedding and the excitement about it is Lillian Monceau, who's owner of Touch of Britain. It's a British food shop and tea room in North Highlands, near the entrance of McClellan Airfield in Sacramento. Lillian, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
Well, what kind of preparations have you been making for the royal wedding? Are you doing anything special?
Well, yes, we are. On Saturday, we're having a tea in celebration of the wedding. And it has been sold out because it's reservations only. And, of course, it has been sold out for at least a month. And with their desserts, they'll get a commemorative cup of the royal, so it's going to be really exciting. I really can't wait.
When you say a special cup, is that a commemorative cup with the picture of the happy couple?
Yes. Well, actually, it isn't a cup, it's a mug.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So, of course, everybody's really excited. And I've had them in the shop, and they've gone out just like hot pancakes. I got them in one day, they were sold all in that one day.
And when you say you're going to be serving a tea, what will that involve? What will you actually be serving?
Well, we're going to have, we'll have the champagne punch and a non-alcoholic punch, and we will have sandwiches and then several desserts. And then we've had a cake made in commemorative of their wedding with their picture on it, so that'll be something nice that'll be extra for them.
Why are you doing it on Saturday? Won't the happy couple be off on their honeymoon by then?
Well, actually, you know, they're going to spend the night, the first night at the palace, and then they'll go on their honeymoon for 2 weeks. But, well, because Friday, you know, a lot of people are working, so we figured it's still going to be in the news. And I thought, well, this be something, you know, that everybody's doing it before. And I thought, well, I'd just be different. And actually, to be honest, I think Saturday for us, it would be the best time.
Yes. My guest is Lillian Monceau, owner of Touch of Britain. Monceau, your last name seems like a French name.
Yes, my husband's from Louisiana, so you know how that goes. They went to Canada, and of course they came here to Louisiana. And as I must say, when my husband, we put 30 years in the military, and we were stationed in France, and the French that they talked in Louisiana is a Bayrouchian French, but luckily they understood him, and he understood them, so it was really, you know, quite a nice trip there.
Now, why is it that there is a British food shop and tea room in North Highlands, just opposite McClellan?
Why? Well, because, you know, when we opened up 25 years ago, there was a lot of British people there, and we figured a lot of the people in the military have already been to England, so, you know, you won't have to go back to England. We can bring England to you.
Now, the wedding happens in the middle of the night, our time. I think it's 3 a.m. our time tomorrow morning. What are your plans? Are you going to stay up late? Are you going to get up early? Or are you just going to TiVo it?
Oh, no, of course not. We'll be up. Yes, I probably will go to bed. We'll be awfully tired in the morning, I'm sure.
Yes. What do you think about the couple? How do you rate their prospects for a happy life together? Because the royal family has had its share of divorce.
Yes, I know. But I think William and Kate's got the head on their shoulders. And I think they're going to... The problem that his parents had, and I think this is what something they have waited so long. And what's so nice about them, they're an ordinary couple, and they don't need a big fuss about anything. I think that's great.
Do you remember well the maybe the most famous royal wedding of recent decades, Charles and Diana?
Actually, no. We were over in Turkey at the time, so we didn't get to see. We did see Fergie, though. As a matter of fact, I've got a replica of the mat that they knelt on in the church, but not of Diane's, which I'm awful sorry about that.
Do you stay in close contact with family and friends in the United Kingdom?
Oh, yes. I have a lot of family, nieces and nephews. Sorry, my parents are gone, but I do have a lot of friends there, too.
And what's the mood like in the UK about the royal wedding? Is there a lot of interest, a lot of excitement?
Oh, I think so. going. Don't you think it's such a joyous thing for something nice to happen like that?
With yeah, all we're overdue.
Pardon?
We're overdue for something nice.
Of course, now I think, well, just like people are now, you know, sleeping on the streets 3 days before the wedding. So that tells you how much that, you know, they're happy for this couple.
My guest is Lillian Munso, owner of Touch of Britain, a British food shop in Tuam. They're going to be marking the royal wedding with a special already sold out tea on Saturday at the Touch of Britain store. The people who go there will get a commemorative mug with a picture of the royal couple. Now, it was just Easter, and I'm guessing you were serving hot cross buns at that time.
Well, actually, we were closed. I do sell the hot cross buns, but, you know, naturally, we were closed on Easter Sunday. You know, that's a family time.
Yes, indeed. But I guess they sell like hot buns.
Oh, there's nothing like the hot cross buns. And the ones I get is from Southern California. They're, of course, I don't mean to be prejudiced, but they're not quite as good as home, but they will do. They're quite good, you know.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, another thing you specialize in serving, and I'm going to pronounce it correctly, scones.
Scones.
Oh, scones. You
say
scones.
Well, it just depends what part of the country. One says scones, one says scones.
That's right. I'm from Scotland, so I say scones.
Pardon?
I'm from Scotland, so I say scones.
Oh, but... all right. Then we won't hold that against you, will we?
But you serve them with Devon cream. I'm sure some people are wondering, what on earth is Devon cream?
Well, it's probably the top of the cream. I really don't know. And we do get it from England. There's a Devon cream, and of course there's a clotted cream too, which clotted cream is a little sweeter than the Devon cream.
But not the healthiest part of the milk, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, you're asking something I really don't know. But all I can say, people love it.
Yes, they do. Well, Lillian Munso, thank you so much for joining us. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun on Saturday for the special tea.
Oh, I am. I'm really looking forward to it. Of course, it's going to be a lot of work, but, you know, you just get this pride of doing this thing for you. You know, they say you can always take the country from the girl, but you can't take the country from the girl. You know what I'm saying?
Indeed.
And I'm sure you've been from Scotland. Are you going to the Scottish Games, Mother's Day?
I might well be. I've gone several times. It's a fine event. You're talking about the ones in Woodland.
Yes, so if you're there, come and say hello, because we're there as a vendor.
Oh, okay. I'll look you up.
And it was nice talking to you.
Well, you too. Thank you, Lillian.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Lillian Munso, owner of Touch of Britain, a British food shop in Tuam. It's on Watt Avenue in North Islands, near the entrance of McClellan Airfield. We've been talking, of course, about the royal wedding, which starts in the middle of the night tomorrow, our time. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, off-air host Nick Bruner joins us for sound advice with new indie rock and pop releases. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and later today on Capital Public Radio News, California voters say they don't want school budgets cut further, but they also don't want their own current tax increases extended. Instead, they say the governor and lawmakers should raise taxes on the wealthy. That's according to a new survey. That story and much more during All Things Considered here on Capital Public Radio. It's time now for our weekly music segment, Sound Advice. With me today, as he is the fourth Thursday of each month, is Nick Bruner, host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's weekly online indie music and occasional comedy show. It's at smartrockradio.org. Nick, thanks for joining us again.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
And the current show is not actually at smartrockradio.org yet.
The current show is here on Insight. We're going to be previewing what's going to publish later on this morning up at smartrockradio.org.
So what happened? Did you wake up too late or something?
I don't know exactly what I did. The internet for, you know, I live there, right? That's where my show lives, but its intricacies and its mysteries are sometimes just beyond me.
Yeah.
So I'm in the middle of tweaking what needs to be tweaked.
But it's coming, and we're going to listen to some of the music. So what are we going to start with?
Oh, man, we're going to start with one of the most distinctive voices that is being tossed in with the realm of indie rock and pop right now. Mr. Bill Callahan has a new album out. It's called Apocalypse. And let's get into this track, and we'll come back and talk about it.
Captain Christofferson, Buck Sergeant Newberry, Leatherneck Jones. Sergeant Cash. What an army. What an Air Force.
Wow. What's going on here?
Okay, so that song is called America with an exclamation point. It's the third track on Apocalypse, and it's really stirring. And I saw your eyes light up. I wish everybody else could have been here to see that. The second that you heard Bill Callahan sing, Jeffrey's eyes just about popped out of his head with surprise. You get just one of the most, just the deepest baritones. Yeah, it's fantastic. Anyway, what I really like about that song overall, it's about 5 minutes long, and it's really stirring in its subtleness. It's very introspective as well. You can hear his internal dialogue. He'll be singing about one thing. It'll almost sound like sort of a PR piece for the country of America. And every once in a while, he'll get even closer to the microphone, and he'll just sort of naturally let his internal dialogue out that sort of follows up what he was singing about before, and then he'll kind of launch back into the song again. So it's really just start to finish a neat piece.
And is this song typical of what he does?
It's a little faster than what he does. In fact, the latest Bill Callahan records have been really, well, I describe it like this in the show. I'd never noticed a distinction between country music and Western music until Bill Callahan. Bill Callahan is distinctly a Western sounding songwriter. Very plains and prairies kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, very nice. I really enjoyed that. It's a Sound Advice on Insight. My guest is Nick Bruner. Moving on
to the latest by two songwriters who never worked together before. Their new album is called, simply enough, Tao and Mira. It's by Tao Nguyen and Mira Yamtov Zeitlin.
And you who said you knew how you were gonna take it, that you'd take it all, that you knew my heart was not that small. And how could we ever manage? Carts and horses could never carry.
Well, that is quite beautiful. I could imagine sitting in a coffee shop in Nevada City listening to that.
Oh, that's a very lovely setting to put that song to. Yes, it's people though who are familiar with their songwriting individually will know that upon the first couple tracks of this record, it really is a very nice melding of both of their styles. There's very distinct, you know, Tao style and very distinct Mira style, and this blends them together seamlessly.
That's very nice. Well, that's our second track on Sound Advice today. What's our third piece?
Oh, this is so much fun. This is the new record by Tune Yards, Oakland-based musician named Meryl Garbus. In fact, she wrote and produced a song for Tao and Mira, but her full length right now on 4AD is called Who Kill?
I've been trying to put my finger on that, and I can't. There's so much going on there.
Rastafarian art hip-hop.
Yes, I like it. That sounds good to me.
I had to think about that one for a while. And it's not even indicative of what the album sounds like overall. There's just a lot of really interesting sonic exploration happening, and it's a joy to listen to from start to finish. I mean, it tickles my brain in ways that I didn't know were possible. Just the different kinds of combinations she comes up with.
on the off-air Facebook page, you asked a question for suggestions for a punk show.
Yes.
And people kept talking about 90s punk.
Mm,
I'm going to go
yes.
old school here. I'm going to make my recommendation.
Please do.
One of the first punk rock singles, Neuros by The Damned.
Oh, The Damned.
Check it out.
That's
awesome.
Excellent.
Okay, so...
Well,
I want
thank
credit
you, Jeffrey.
If you do it.
Well, I have a running tally right now at Facebook. We're looking for suggestions for an all punk rock show, and I have a running tally back at my desk. I will definitely add you to it.
Yeah, it's from 1976. It's great. So we're going to continue now with non-1976 punk, no doubt.
Indeed, it's actually going to. Well, you know, it sounds a little bit 70s in that it's sort of Carpenters-esque pop. This is a group from Olympia, Washington, called Lake.
Look at this painting and all of its colors. Just like a lucid dream goes on and on and on and on and on. And they go on and on and on. One man pushed a boulder down the hill. While the other man was the
like if the Carpenters decided to get into disco almost.
If it were possible to hug a song, I would hug that song. It's called
yes.
Roger Miller, and their new album by Lake is called Giving and Receiving, and it almost didn't happen. They recorded an analog tape that started to fall apart midway through the recording process, so they had to scramble, get as much of it onto computers as they could, and then rewrite sections, if I have my story straight.
It's a really nice song, and of course it's called Roger Miller.
Of course it is. Yes, it is the famed country singer and songwriter himself. It's that song, by the way, is indicative very much of the overall Lake sound, and I'd recommend it strongly.
Very nice. Well, we've got time for one more song.
Oh, yes. This was recorded here in Sacramento under our very noses, under the supergroup Wild Flag, featuring two-thirds of the band Slater Kinney, as well as Mary Timoney and Rebecca Cole. The song is called Glass Tambourine.
Listen to the music, before it passes you by.
So they came here, recorded it. You've done quite a few of those now.
Well, they didn't record it here in CPR.
Oh, I see, here in Sacramento, yeah.
They have just finished mastering their debut LP for Merge Records at The Hangar here in Sacramento. But they have played here at what's now been shuttered, the Sacramento secret venue, The Hub. And once our show this week goes live, you'll see a nice little eulogy for that venue at our the website as well.
And the show will go live, hopefully in a matter of hours.
Mm-hmm. SmartRockRadio.org. In the meantime, boy, there are just hours and hours and hours of back episodes you can listen to and familiarize yourself with.
And we have a few seconds left, Nick, so I'll just ask you about this question you've been posing on Facebook, too. What's your best reason to support public radio? Why do you ask this question?
Well, it's our Fun Drive episode as well, episode number 119, and I thought I would get just the best answers I could about what makes this show worth your support.
And we'll be talking about that very issue for about 8 days, starting soon.
I think we will, you and I and many other people. Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so if you like Capital Public Radio, make sure you show your support for Insight and or Off Air. We'll be making that case tomorrow. But in the meantime, Nick Bruner, host of Off Air, thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you so much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Liz Cazares, Christine Guerra, and Sosin Marar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard, and we will be back tomorrow. Indiana's Chief Justice is in town to receive a Peace Award from Sacramento State. On the next Insight, we'll talk with Georgina Theodora Wood about her work in the rule of law in Africa. Plus, a local theater company opens a retelling of Antigone, and B-movie horror Planet of the Vampire Women gets its world premiere. The film was made in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.